We would like to send out a special thanks to Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike other puzzle games out there. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. You can download it free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
June 13th, 1977. Mays County, Oklahoma. While attending a summer camp for Girl Scouts, 10-year-old Denise Milner, 9-year-old Michelle Gousset, and 8-year-old Lori Farmer spend the night together in a tent. When morning hits, the murdered bodies of the three girls are discovered 150 yards away in the woods. Evidence seems to point to a wanted fugitive named Jean Leroy Hart, and after a long manhunt, he is captured and charged with the murders. Hart eventually goes on trial for the crime, but is acquitted by the jury. Hart soon dies of a heart attack, and since all further attempts to link him to the crime are inconclusive, the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders officially remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our four-year anniversary show of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warner, and per tradition, every year I like to mark our anniversary by covering a case which was voted on by you, the listeners. And this year, we'll be covering a very infamous and horrific crime, the murders of Denise Milner, Michelle Gousset, and Lori Farmer, a.k.a. the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders. That voice you just heard narrate our intro was Ashlyn O'Brien, the winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Ashlyn. This has been a popular recurring monthly contest for the past 2.5 years, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, ever since the inception of this podcast, the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders has been one of my most highly requested cases, which is probably why it won this year's poll. This is the type of crime that nightmares are made of, as it took place at a Girl Scout camp, and involved three young victims who were attacked inside their tent and murdered in the middle of the night, but even though many other people were camping nearby, no one saw a thing. A suspect named Jean Leroy Hart would be charged and go on trial for the crime, but even though he was a wanted fugitive with a prior history of violence, the jury ultimately believed that the evidence of his involvement in the Girl Scout murders was not strong enough to convict. While Hart was found not guilty, he would die only a few months later while serving time in prison for his other crimes. Over the years, DNA testing has been conducted on the evidence in an attempt to determine if Hart really did commit these murders, but the results have always been inconclusive. After 4 decades, it's still up in the air if Hart was innocent or guilty. So on this episode, we're going to explore whether the authorities got the right man the first time around, or if the real killer managed to get away with it. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders. Our story begins in Oklahoma in 1977. Our three victims are 8-year-old Lori Lee Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Heather Gousset, and 10-year-old Doris Denise Milner, who goes by the name Denise. The three girls live with their families in the Broken Arrow suburb of Tulsa and all belong to the Magic Empire Council of Girl Scouts. They are planning to start off the summer by spending 2 weeks attending Camp Scott, a 410-acre campground which is located in Mays County, 2 miles outside the town of Locust Grove, and has been in operation for nearly 50 years by this point. On Sunday, June 10th, Denise, Michelle, Lori, and many other Girl Scouts all boarded a bus at the Magic Empire Council headquarters in Tulsa in order to make the 50-mile trip to Camp Scott. In total, over 130 girls would be attending and split up into separate units, which were each named after a Native American tribe, with Denise, Michelle, and Lori being assigned to the Kiowa unit. Before they arrived, the three girls did not know each other, but since they did not know anyone else in the Kiowa unit either, they all wound up sharing the same tent together. Each of the tents measured 12 by 14 feet, contained 4 cots, and sat on top of a wooden platform. The Kiowa unit consisted of 7 tents for the campers and a separate tent for the counselors, and Denise, Michelle, and Lori were assigned to Tent 7, which happened to be the most remote one. It was located right next to the woods, and a building containing showers and a kitchen would obscure the view of Tent 7 from the counselor's tent, which was located 86 yards away. A thunderstorm would hit the area that night, so the campers and counselors would spend most of the evening participating in activities inside the mess hall before they returned to their tents. Michelle Hoffman, a 15-year-old former camper who was now working as an aide to the camp director, soon went to Tent 7 to check on the three girls. When they originally boarded the bus in Tulsa, Denise was reluctant to go because some of her friends had planned to attend Camp Scott alongside her, but had since backed out. So Michelle offered to share the front seat with Denise on the bus ride there in order to help put her at ease. When Michelle checked Tent 7, Denise appeared to be adjusting well to her new surroundings, so she said goodnight to the girls. Everyone would soon be asleep in their respective tents, but sometime during the night, an horrific crime would take place. Shortly after 6 a.m. on the morning of June 13th, Carla Wilhite, an 18-year-old counselor with the Kiowa unit, woke up and left her tent in order to use the showers. She noticed what appeared to be 3 large objects lying next to the trail in the woods. When Carla took a closer look, she was horrified to discover that the objects were a trio of sleeping bags and that the body of Denise Milner was lying on top of one of them. She was nude from the waist down, with her pajama top pulled up underneath her arms. Her hands were tied behind her back with duct tape and nylon rope, and the rope was wrapped around her neck. She had also been gagged with a terry cloth towel, and an elastic bandage was used as a blindfold on her. It would also turn out that the bodies of Michelle Gousset and Lori Farmer were right next to Denise, zipped up inside their own respective sleeping bags. The two girls had been bludgeoned to death when someone struck the back of their heads with a blunt instrument. While Denise was also struck across the face with a blunt object, her exact cause of death was strangulation. The bodies were discovered 150 yards away from Tent 7, and a search of the tent would reveal traces of blood on 2 of the cots, and smeared blood on the wooden platform. It appeared that the perpetrator had entered the tent and bludgeoned Michelle and Lori on their cots while they slept, and then proceeded to take Denise outside into the woods to murder her. Impressions on the ground next to Denise's body seemed to indicate that a struggle had taken place there. While they were still inside their sleeping bags, the bodies of Michelle and Lori were removed from the tent and placed beside Denise. Michelle's wrists had been tied to the side of her body with the rope in what almost resembled a hogtie position. An autopsy would reveal that Denise and Michelle were raped, and all 3 girls had been sexually molested. It seemed like someone had made an unsuccessful attempt to clean up the blood inside the tent with the bedsheets from the cots, which were found inside the sleeping bags alongside the victims. A bloody footprint which appeared to be from a size 10 military-style boot was also on the platform and had been smeared over, and there was also an additional bloody footprint which resembled a size 7 tennis shoe. Law enforcement, including agents from the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, aka the OSBI, would be summoned to Camp Scott to investigate the scene. The only entrance to the camp was the front gate, which was still locked that morning, so it was apparent that the perpetrator had scaled over the fence surrounding the campground and walked through the woods towards the Kiowa unit. A roll of masking tape and a large 9-volt flashlight were found near the murder scene. Some green plastic had also been placed over the flashlight's lens, and the perpetrator made a small pencil-sized hole in the plastic, which likely allowed them to navigate through the darkness without their light being as noticeable. The owner of a nearby ranch would later report a burglary that took place prior to the murders, in which numerous items were stolen from his home, including tape and nylon rope, and a similar military-style boot print was found outside his door. Oddly, multiple pairs of glasses which had been stolen from various campers in the middle of the night were also found scattered around the area. Needless to say, the murders prompted the camp staff to inform the other Girl Scouts that they needed to pack up and go home without actually telling them what happened. A calculated attempt was made to keep the other campers shielded from the murder scene before they were boarded on a bus and driven back to the Magic Empire Council headquarters in Tulsa to reunite with their worried parents. Many of the campers would later say that they had no idea three girls had been killed until after they returned home. The parents of Denise, Michelle, and Lori would be informed that their daughters were dead, but specific details about what happened were not initially shared with them. In fact, they only found out their children had been murdered after hearing about it in the media. It also turned out that the director of Camp Scott made phone calls to his lawyers and insurance companies before he finally made contact with the victims' families. In a tragic postscript, letters which all three girls had written for their parents on the night of the murders were found among their possessions. In fact, in Denise's letter, she mentioned feeling homesick and said she did not want to spend the full 2 weeks at camp. In addition, Lori, who happened to be the youngest camper at Camp Scott, was only 5 days shy of her 9th birthday, and her parents were planning to visit the campground on that date to celebrate with her. In an eerie twist of fate, a fourth girl had been assigned to Tent 7 alongside the three victims. Due to a clerical error involving her age, she wound up spending her first night at the camp with a different unit, a mistake which may have ultimately saved her life. Some of the people who stayed over at Camp Scott would recall some odd occurrences which took place throughout the night. One counselor claimed she saw what looked like a dim light inside the woods. When she shined her own flashlight over in that direction, the dim light seemed to disappear. There was speculation that this may have originated from the 9-volt flashlight left behind at the scene, which had plastic obscuring its lens. One of the girls inside Tent 6 recalled being awakened by someone opening their tent flap. She then saw a brief silhouette of a large individual quickly shining a light inside before they left. The girl initially thought it might have been one of the counselors checking in on them, but no counselors admitted to entering Tent 6. A camper from a different unit also remembered hearing a scream from the direction of the Kiowa unit that night, and another camper from another unit thought they heard what sounded like a girl crying out, "Mama, Mama." It also turned out that a creepy incident took place at Camp Scott less than 2 months prior to the murders. At the time, an on-site training session was being held at Camp Scott for the counselors and staff. Michelle Hoffman, the same girl who had consoled Denise during the bus ride to the camp, was present at the session and claimed that she returned to one of the cabins and discovered it had been ransacked. A box of donuts had been sitting there, but the donuts were now gone, and someone had left a handwritten note inside the box, which stated that 3 or 4 girls would be murdered. However, the session director just wrote the incident off as a prank, possibly conducted by someone from a nearby Boy Scout camp, so the note was thrown away and could not be analyzed as evidence once the murders took place. In the end, the crime proved so devastating that Camp Scott had to be closed permanently and has never been reopened. Law enforcement would orchestrate a massive manhunt of the area surrounding Camp Scott in an attempt to find the killer, which eventually led to the abandoned foundation of a house located about a mile away. A number of items of interest would be found inside the house's cellar and a nearby cave, including empty food cans, a partial roll of tape which matched the tape found at the murder scene, a pair of gloves, a slingshot, and some women's underwear. But there were two items in particular which suggested that the killer had been there. A pair of broken glasses inside a beige vinyl case which had been stolen from one of the camp counselors, and pieces of newspaper from the April 17th edition of the Tulsa World. Newspaper from that very same edition had been used to hold the battery in place inside the flashlight from the murder scene. Graffiti would also be found written in marker on the wall of another cave, which read, quote, 77617, the killer was here, bye-bye fools, end quote. However, the most unusual discovery in the cellar was a pair of tattered photographs featuring what appeared to be two women at a wedding. These photos would be published in the newspapers, and it wasn't long before people came forward who thought they recognized them. The wedding in question had taken place in 1968, and the bride was the daughter of an employee who worked at a prison known as the Oklahoma State Reformatory. It turned out that one of the inmates there had been granted permission to work as an assistant in the darkroom to help develop the photographs of the wedding and make prints of them. The inmate in question was Jean Leroy Hart, a Cherokee Indian who grew up in Locust Grove, a short distance away from Camp Scott. During high school, Hart was known as a star football player with a promising future, but things went bad in 1966 when he abducted two 19-year-old pregnant women at gunpoint as they were leaving a Tulsa nightclub. He bound both of the victims with duct tape and nylon rope before forcing them into the trunk of his car and driving them out to a remote area. He then pulled one of the women out and raped her in the back seat, while the other one heard the whole thing from inside the trunk. After driving to another location, Hart took both women onto a wooded hillside area where he proceeded to strip, rape, and sodomize them. The nude victims were then hogtied in a fetal position and had their eyes, mouths, and noses covered with friction tape before Hart left the scene. Since all of their air holes were cut off, it seemed like Hart intended for the women to suffocate, but one of them managed to loosen the tape from her mouth and free herself and her friend before they went to get help. Since one of the victims had seen Hart's license number, police were able to track him down and arrest him, and he was positively identified by both victims. Interestingly enough, both victims also wore glasses, and Hart tried each pair on to test their prescriptions while he was driving. Anyway, Hart wound up pleading guilty to two charges of kidnapping and one charge of first-degree rape, and was sentenced to three concurrent 10-year prison terms. Hart would only serve 28 months of his sentence before he was paroled, but he was arrested again in May of 1969 on four counts of first-degree burglary. This time, Hart was found guilty of all charges at trial and was given consecutive prison sentences totaling 305 years at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. In 1973, Hart was temporarily transferred from the prison to the Mays County Jail in the town of Pryor because he was going to provide testimony at the local courthouse in hopes of seeking some post-conviction relief. However, Hart used this opportunity to escape from the jail, and while he was recaptured a short time later, he subsequently escaped from the same jail again, and this time, he could not be found. At the time the Girl Scout murders took place, Hart was 33 years old and had been a wanted fugitive for nearly 4 years. The discovery of the photographs caused Hart to become the prime suspect, and on June the 23rd, Mays County District Attorney Sid Wise called a press conference to announce that Hart was being charged with three counts of first-degree murder. This led to the largest manhunt in the history of Oklahoma, but Hart could not be found. Mays County had a large Native American population, and since Hart had no fewer than 250 relatives living in the area, there was a lot of suspicion that people were helping him hide from the authorities. The problem is that a number of local residents believed that Hart was being railroaded and being used as a convenient scapegoat to solve the crime. There were rumors that Mays County Sheriff Glenn Pete Weaver had a personal grudge against Hart for breaking out of his county jail on two separate occasions years earlier. The American Indian Movement even publicly expressed their support for Hart, fearing that he would be shot down by the authorities before he could be taken alive. As a result, an open letter was printed in the Tulsa World newspaper in which law enforcement and the governor of Oklahoma assured Hart that he would receive fair treatment and not be harmed if he surrendered himself peacefully. In spite of this, Hart managed to stay off the radar for nearly a year, but on April 6, 1978, he was finally tracked down to an isolated tar paper and wood shack located in the Cookson Hills of Cherokee County. The shack was located approximately 50 miles from Camp Scott, and an elderly Cherokee medicine man named Sam Pigeon had been allowing Hart to stay there. When law enforcement arrived, they formally arrested Hart and took him into custody on 3 counts of first-degree murder, to which he would enter a plea of not guilty. The trial would begin in March of 1979 at the Mays County Courthouse in Pryor, but by this point, the entire case had become a media circus. Instead of Mays County District Attorney Sid Wise, the lead prosecutor would be Tulsa County District Attorney S.M. Buddy Fallis. 6 months before Hart was even captured, Wise had signed a contract to work on a book about the case and provided his co-author with confidential files, so he was forced to withdraw from the trial. Hart would be represented by attorney Garvin Isaacs, as many residents of the county had helped raise money for his defense. The Cherokee Nation Tribal Council even donated $12,500, and Hart had a slew of supporters show up at the courthouse throughout the trial. It was ruled that the prosecution would not be allowed to introduce Hart's previous rape convictions into evidence for fear that it might prejudice the jury. But regardless, they announced that if Hart was found guilty of the murders, they would seek the death penalty. Hart's alibi for the night of the crime was that he was at his uncle's house in Tulsa, but since his uncle had passed away before Hart was captured, this alibi could not be corroborated. The trial would contain a lot of debate about the physical evidence against Hart. Hair samples had been found in Tent 7 and on the tape used to bind Denise Milner, and the prosecution believed they were a match to Hart's hair. But the defense produced a chemist who compared the hair samples, and he testified that while they had the same microscopic characteristics, he could not conclude with 100% certainty that the hairs were a match. However, the biggest debate would involve some semen samples which were found at the murder scene. The semen contained traces of sperm, but Hart had once gotten a vasectomy, which should have prevented him from producing sperm, so the defense argued that this was evidence that he could not have committed the crime. But the prosecution argued that Hart's vasectomy was only partially successful because it was performed by a doctor who was 78 years old. This meant he could have been capable of producing deformed, non-productive sperm, and indeed, traces of deformed, decomposed sperm were found on the undershorts Hart was wearing when he was arrested, which was described as being similar to the sperm from the crime scene. The semen was also described as being from a non-white male with type O blood who was a secretor, characteristics which all matched Hart, but once again, an expert testified that even though the sperm samples were similar, they could not state with absolute certainty that they originated from the same person. The partial fingerprint found on the 9-volt flashlight did not match Hart, and in fact, none of his fingerprints could be found at the murder scene at all. The bloody boot print and footprint from the tennis shoe inside Tent 7 also did not match Hart, and issues were raised about the sloppiness of the evidence collection. For example, a palm print had been discovered inside the tent, but it turned out it was accidentally left there by an OSBI agent. The prosecution attempted to link Hart to the items found inside the cellar and cave by producing a witness named Larry Dry, who had broken out of the Mays County Jail alongside Hart in 1973 and testified that they spent time hiding out at that same location together. However, the defense would allege that some of the evidence against Hart had been planted, including the wedding photographs. A former Mays County jailer testified that he had seen these exact same photos on the desk of Sheriff Weaver before Hart was captured, though Weaver counteracted this by producing a property receipt for the photos which had been signed by Hart. The most controversial pieces of evidence were a small hand mirror and a toy corncob pipe which had been found inside the shack where Hart was captured. One of the counselors from Camp Scott testified that these items belonged to her and had been inside a trunk she brought to the camp. Following the murders, the trunk was confiscated by police, and she noticed the items were missing when the trunk was returned to her a few weeks later. But Sam Pigeon, the medicine man who had been hiding Hart inside his shack, testified that he never saw those items the entire time Hart was staying there. Indeed, since the pipe and the mirror were not discovered until law enforcement conducted a second search of the shack, the defense believed this was an indicator that the evidence was planted by Sheriff Weaver. The defense would also present an alternate suspect to the crime, a convicted criminal named William Stevens, who was currently serving a life sentence in the Kansas State Penitentiary for the kidnapping, robbery, and rape of a woman. Stevens had an accomplice in the crime named Dwayne Peters, who claimed that Stevens had been working on an oil drilling rig near Camp Scott at the time of the murders, and once confessed the crime to him while under the influence of alcohol and marijuana, though Peters would later recant the story. Peters' girlfriend and her son lived in the town of Ocmulgee and testified that she believed the 9-volt flashlight found at the murder scene belonged to her, as it contained a distinct broken switch which had recently been repaired. In the weeks prior to the murders, Stevens had apparently borrowed the flashlight from the girlfriend, and both she and her son would testify that Stevens showed up at their home on the morning of June the 13th, 1977, and that he appeared to have claw marks on his arms and neck, as well as red stains on his boots. An employee at a cafe in the town of Shuto, located 15 miles from Camp Scott, testified that she saw Stevens in the establishment between 5 and 6 a.m. on the morning of June 13th, where he took his shirt off and appeared very nervous. Additional testimony was also provided by a girl who had been camping at Camp Scott. After looking at a photograph of Stevens, she claimed she had seen a man resembling him lurking outside her tent with a flashlight days before the murders took place. When one of the other girls opened the tent flap and shined her own flashlight in the man's face, he took off. Stevens' alibi for the time period of the murders was that he was working in the town of Seminole, 130 miles away, and the prosecution produced a time card and a canceled paycheck to support his story. Stevens' fingerprints also did not match the print found on the flashlight, and a forensic chemist testified that the hair and semen samples from the murder scene did not match Stevens or Dwayne Peters. In the end, no conclusive evidence could be found to link Stevens to the crime, and he would be stabbed to death at the Kansas State Penitentiary in 1984. Well, the case would finally go to the jury on March 29th, and after deliberating for 6 hours without a verdict, they retired for the night. But when deliberations resumed the following morning, it would only be a half an hour before they announced they had reached a verdict, and they wound up finding Hart not guilty on all 3 counts of murder. The jury was very critical of how the investigation was handled, and clearly did not believe that the evidence was strong enough to prove Hart's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, one juror would later admit that they took a unanimous not guilty vote only 5 minutes into deliberations, which they never wavered from after discussing the case for the next 6 hours. The authorities believed that the verdict was a miscarriage of justice and announced that there would be no further investigation on the case. Sheriff Weaver expressed his belief that he was, quote-unquote, 1,000% certain that Hart was still guilty and said that no other suspects would be pursued. But of course, Hart's acquittal did not mean he would be free to walk the streets again. As you recall, he had spent years as a wanted fugitive, and he would now be returned to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary to continue serving out his previous sentences for burglary. Since these sentences totaled over 300 years, this meant that Hart would remain locked up for the remainder of his life, which turned out to be a lot shorter than everyone expected. On June the 4th, just over 2 months after his acquittal, Hart was working out in the prison exercise yard when he suddenly succumbed to a fatal heart attack at the age of 35. Since Hart's family had a history of heart problems, and the medical examiner found severe blockage in his heart, there was no reason to believe his death was anything but natural causes. Interestingly enough, the autopsy did confirm that Hart's vasectomy had not been successful, and he was still capable of producing deformed sperm. Hart's funeral was held in Locust Grove and drew nearly 1,300 mourners, the largest funeral in the history of Mays County up until that point. The families of Denise Milner and Lori Farmer would decide to file a $5 million civil lawsuit against the Magic Empire Council of Girl Scouts and their insurer for negligence, arguing that the lack of security precautions at Camp Scott allowed the murders to happen. The civil trial took place in March of 1985, but by a decision of 9-3, the jury ultimately ruled in favor of the Magic Empire Council. In spite of this, the victims' families would attempt to use the tragedy to help others. Michelle Gousset's father, Richard Gousset, successfully lobbied the state legislature to pass the Oklahoma Victims' Bill of Rights and helped found the Oklahoma Crime Victims' Compensation Board, while Lori Farmer's mother, Sherry Farmer, founded the Oklahoma chapter of a support group called Parents of Murdered Children, launching it on what would have been Lori's 16th birthday. Even though Jean Leroy Hart was now deceased, everyone was hoping that advances in forensic science might help conclusively determine if he actually committed the crime. In 1989, DNA testing would be performed on the evidence, but unfortunately, it did not lead to a definitive resolution. A comparison was made between the semen samples from the murder scene and body fluids taken from Hart, but the results showed that only 3 of the 5 probes of DNA were a match. This meant the odds were that only 1 in 7,700 American Indians would match the samples, whereas if all 5 of the probes had matched, the odds would have been 1 in 3 billion. So the only determination which could be made was that the results were inconclusive. In 2007, some new DNA testing would be performed on some stains found on a pillowcase inside the tent, but the samples turned out to be too deteriorated to obtain a full DNA profile. Over the course of the past few years, the Mays County Sheriff's Department has been attempting to raise money in order to perform more advanced DNA testing, but this has yet to come to fruition. After 4 decades, all attempts to definitively prove or disprove that Jean Leroy Hart was the perpetrator have been unsuccessful, so there are still no conclusive answers about who actually committed the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. We've just reached our 4-year podiversary, so obviously, that must mean my biggest passion is true crime. But when you're producing a non-stop series of episodes over the course of 4 years, you still require the occasional break. So that's why when I need a mental palate cleanser, my go-to refresher is Best Fiends. What better respite from true crime than a fun game where most of the characters are cute bugs and the antagonists are not-so-cute slugs? As you all know, this podcast deals exclusively with unsolved cold cases, which can often be massive jigsaw puzzles, so trying to figure out what actually happened really engages my brain. Well, I'm happy to say that Best Fiends functions the exact same way by providing you with fun, challenging puzzles to solve, but it's also a casual game that anyone can play, and it's made for adults. You can spend as much or as little time as you'd like in the game. Best Fiends also has a nice visual design with very bright and vibrant colors to keep you engaged. Over the course of the past several months, I've been keeping you updated on my progress on the game, and given that I've just reached a special milestone for this podcast, I guess I should mention that I've also reached a special milestone for Best Fiends, level 250. But even though I've been playing it for a long time, Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. It is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike other puzzle games out there. So engage your brain with puzzles and collect tons of cute characters too. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. So download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you and enjoy the rest of the episode. So like I mentioned in the intro, This has always been one of my most highly requested cases ever since the inception of this podcast, and I'm not overly surprised that it won the poll to be featured on this episode. It's certainly not hard to imagine why this case has managed to stick with people for over 40 years, because not only is it absolutely terrifying, but if you've ever gone camping before, it's very relatable. When I was around the same age as the victims in this case, I was in Cub Scouts and went on my fair share of camping trips, and I could certainly identify with the feelings of homesickness that Denise Milner seemed to have. While attending these camps, it was always standard practice to tell each other scary stories and sometimes play pranks or make weird noises in the middle of the night in order to freak people out. I know that some of the campers and counselors remembered hearing strange noises on the night of the murders, and while some might question why they didn't take this as a bigger warning sign, I can tell you that this type of thing was par for the course whenever I went on camping trips, and I understand why people would have been inclined to write off these events as horseplay or other silliness involving children. I mean, many of the counselors at Camp Scott were just teenagers themselves, and had gone through this same experience when they were younger children. Before this tragedy, I do not believe there had ever been a documented case of a child being murdered at a Girl Scout camp, so I'm sure no one anticipated that someone would have been capable of sneaking onto the property and brutally murdering three girls in the middle of the night, undetected. Of course, it's extra tragic when you consider that these particular victims, Denise, Michelle, and Lori, were all grouped together in the same tent because they were the only girls who didn't really know anybody else in the Kiowa unit, so I'm sure they were feeling extra vulnerable. It doesn't seem likely that any of the three girls were specifically targeted and were likely selected at random because they just happened to be inside the most remote, isolated tent in the unit. So essentially, they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, even though this is one of the most heavily discussed unsolved cold cases of the past 50 years, what's unusual is that closure might have actually been attained a long time ago, but no one could be 100% certain. Even though he was acquitted at trial, a lot of people believe that Jean Leroy Hart was still guilty of this crime. He wound up dying of a heart attack in prison only a few months later, so if he actually did it, then I suppose you could take the attitude that karma caught up with this guy and justice was ultimately served. You would think that with all the major advances in forensics over the past four decades, it might be possible to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt whether or not Hart committed this crime, yet this just hasn't occurred. But even if conclusive evidence surfaced that Hart did it, there's still some question about whether he acted alone. Given that he previously abducted and raped two pregnant women, there's little doubt that Hart was a bad guy who was capable of terrible crimes, but brutally murdering three children single-handedly is still a whole nother level. Anyway, in 1983, a book was published about this case titled Someone Cry for the Children, written by Dick and Michael Wilkerson, a pair of brothers who worked as investigators for the OSBI. 12 years later, Michael Wilkerson decided to produce a documentary under the same title, which was narrated by actor Dale Robertson and Johnny Cash. Yes, that Johnny Cash. You can watch Someone Cry for the Children on YouTube, and hearing Johnny Cash narrate a true crime documentary is unique, to say the least. Watching the documentary, it's quite eye-opening to see just how much support Jean Leroy Hart received when he went on trial for this crime. In fact, from the moment he was named as the prime suspect, there were a number of people who thought he was being railroaded because he was a Cherokee Indian. Indeed, Mays County had quite a substantial Native American population who believed that prejudice was going to play a role in making Hart a convenient scapegoat. I'm not going to deny the possibility that there's some truth to that, as there were problematic aspects of the investigation. It is pretty surprising that following the discovery of the items inside the cellar and the cave, the Mays County District Attorney publicly announced that Hart was being charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder. I can definitely understand getting Hart's name out there and announcing that he was wanted for questioning, as he was technically still a wanted fugitive from his escape from the jail years earlier. But at that point, there really wasn't that much evidence at all linking Hart to the crime, so I do think it was a bit presumptuous to flat out charge him with the murders, and I can understand the fear that law enforcement would kill Hart before he could be taken alive and conveniently pin the crime on a dead man. All that being said, it still blows my mind that Hart had so many supporters. Yes, if he did not actually commit these murders, then he did not deserve to be convicted of them, but it's clear that people went way too far to paint him as some sort of folk hero. There's a very infamous photograph, which was published in news articles about this case, of an attorney wearing a t-shirt which read, "Gene Hart for Attorney General," and a number of t-shirts just like that were sold to help raise money for his defense fund. But somehow, I don't think they sold a t-shirt which read, "Gene Hart rapes pregnant women." Yes, it seems like Hart's supporters were willing to jump through some major hoops to rationalize that crime, claiming that the two victims had actually gone off with Hart voluntarily and climbed into the trunk of his car on their own to hide from their husbands. They tried to claim that the only reason Hart pled guilty to this crime was because he knew he would receive a much worse sentence if he was convicted at trial. Well, in actuality, it's only by good fortune that Hart didn't successfully murder those two women, as he covered their entire faces with tape and clearly meant for them to suffocate to death in the woods, but they thankfully managed to free themselves and survive. I see no indication that Hart ever expressed any remorse for this crime, and even though he served a pretty light sentence before he was paroled, he almost immediately got rearrested again for committing multiple burglaries and was on the run from the law as a prison escapee at the time he was charged with the Girl Scout murders. Once again, if Hart was actually innocent of those murders, then he deserved the best representation to ensure he received a fair trial, but let's not pretend he was a good guy. It's pretty sad that the families of the three murdered girls were made to feel like the villains at the trial and needed protection because they faced harassment from Hart's supporters. You'll find numerous articles and podcasts, such as the True Crime Garage episodes about this case, which have made parallels between Hart's trial and the O.J. Simpson trial, and that is an apt comparison. While Hart was nowhere near as big a football star as O.J. Simpson, it seems like his football exploits in high school had always made him a popular figure in the community. In both cases, there were allegations that the police planted evidence in order to frame the defendant, who wound up becoming a symbol of systemic racism from the authorities, and kind of overshadowed the question of whether they were actually guilty of the crime they were charged with. It must be clarified, however, that there were no Native Americans on this particular jury, so I'm not sure if this played any role in their decision to acquit Hart. It sounds like they reached their verdict because they had serious issues with how the investigation was handled, and legitimately believed that the prosecution did not prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. All that being said, I'm always fascinated by the psychology of putting people on trial while they are already incarcerated for other crimes. The prosecution was not allowed to use Hart's previous rape and kidnapping convictions as evidence against him, but ironically, it was the defense who introduced Hart's prior criminal history into the trial by casually mentioning that he was already facing 300 years in prison. I don't know if that strategy was intentional on their part, but it may have helped plant the seed that even if the jury voted to acquit Hart, he was still going back to prison no matter what. Now think about the psychology of this. When you're on a jury, you're not supposed to find someone guilty if you believe there's reasonable doubt, but if someone is on trial for murdering three children, I'm sure jurors will always have that fear in the back of their minds about getting it wrong and potentially allowing a person like that back out onto the streets to harm someone else. There's a chance this could prevent them from voting not guilty, but if you know that someone is still going to spend the rest of their life behind bars for other crimes, regardless of the verdict, then you may feel more comfortable about them being acquitted. I'm not saying this was the jury's mindset at Hart's trial, but this is a pretty unique situation. To make another comparison to another murder case involving a football player, look at what happened when Aaron Fernandez went on trial in 2017 for the murders of Daniel De Abreu and Safira Furtado. By this point, Hernandez had already been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the murder of Odin Lloyd, so even though the jury found him not guilty of those two murders, he was not walking free. Like Hart, Hernandez was acquitted and died in prison a short time later, though his death was suicide. According to a juror from Hart's trial, they had pretty much made up their minds 5 minutes into deliberations that they were going to find Hart not guilty, but you do have to wonder if they would have had a different mindset if the verdict would have resulted in Hart going free. Regardless of the acquittal, it seems like the authorities were still convinced that Hart was the guilty party and brought an end to their investigation, and unfortunately, if someone else actually did commit the murders, this pretty much drove home the message that they had gotten away with it. So now let's start exploring the crime and figure out the likelihood of Hart being the culprit. There are many odd aspects to this case, and one of the strangest has to be the alleged discovery of a threatening note inside a donut box at Camp Scott less than 2 months before the murders took place. The story goes that the note stated some girls were going to be murdered, but the director just thought it was a prank and threw the note away. There are differing accounts about whether the note specifically mentioned 3 or 4 girls being murdered, but that's because the note was never found, so it seems like the individual people who saw it remember it differently. Well, if the note was legitimate, and the killer actually wrote it, then I suspect that it would have read 4, as it was standard practice to assign 4 girls to each tent, and the only reason there were 3 girls inside Tent 7 on the night of the murders is because the 4th girl had mistakenly been assigned to another unit. I am a bit skeptical that the note was legitimate, because I'm not sure why the perpetrator would announce this ahead of time. If the Magic Empire Council had been on the ball and actually took the note more seriously, then they could have tightened security and made it considerably more difficult for the perpetrator to commit the crime. But I also have no trouble believing that the killer was someone who was watching the camp for a long period of time and knew the layout. I really don't think it's any coincidence that he selected Tent 7, since it was the most isolated and located closest to the woods, and the presence of the small building containing the kitchen and showers obscured the view from the counselor's tent. We also had an account from one of the girls in Tent 6 that someone briefly looked inside their tent with a flashlight in the middle of the night, and if this was the killer, he may have been checking all the tents and chose Tent 7 when he saw only 3 girls were in there. One of the main reasons some people have speculated that more than one person was involved in the crime is because it seems like it would have been difficult for one individual to subdue all 3 of the girls by themselves. But the evidence seemed to show that Michelle and Lori were bludgeoned while they were still sleeping on their cots and never even had a chance to fight back, so the killer probably only had to worry about subduing Denise. On the other hand, if not for a clerical error, there technically should have been 4 girls inside the tent that night, and it seems pretty brazen for one person to single-handedly attack that many victims. I guess it would all depend on whether the killer knew beforehand how many people would be there. I do think the fact that all 3 victims were found 150 yards away from the tent is a bit surprising. When you look at a map of the layout, you'll see that in order to travel from Tent 7 to that exact spot, you have to pass by the counselor's tent, so there's a greater risk of being seen. That's why I think there's a good chance that when the killer bludgeoned Michelle and Lori, Denise woke up and escaped the tent to make a run for it, but the killer eventually caught her, bound her, and gagged her before she was assaulted and murdered at that spot on the trail. Another detail which always struck me as odd is that the killer made an attempt to clean up the blood inside the tent, but it seems like they ultimately gave up and stuffed the bedsheets they used inside the sleeping bags alongside Lori and Michelle's bodies before carrying them out into the woods. I'm not sure there's much purpose to cleaning up the murder scene when the bodies are going to be left behind, and again, it seems like a risk to travel 150 yards and walk past the counselor's tent to transport Lori and Michelle to that same spot. Whatever the case, the actual blunt object which was used to bludgeon these girls was never found, but if it had been, it could have played a role in nailing down a perpetrator. One of the most controversial elements in this case was the presence of the bloody boot print and tennis shoe print found on the wooden platform inside the tent, neither of which seemed to match Hart's shoe size. Of course, this doesn't exonerate Hart, since some people have taken this as evidence that multiple individuals were involved in the crime. But the problematic issue is whether any of the physical evidence found in the tent can be considered reliable, since the authorities did not do such a good job of preserving the scene. This is supported by the fact that a palm print which belonged to an OSBI agent was found there, so who's to say that the boot print couldn't have belonged to one of the people who worked the scene? That size 7 shoe print really does seem too small to have been left by Hart, but too big to have belonged to any of the three victims. Though I could see some of the camp counselors or staff members having shoes that size. Interestingly enough, when new DNA testing was conducted on a semen-stained pillowcase in 2007, they did find a degraded, partial, mini-STR DNA profile that genetically typed as female from one of the stains. Apparently, two of the victims were excluded as being the source of the DNA, but they couldn't exclude all three of them. During an article about this discovery in the Oklahoman, Lori Farmer's mother, Sherry, expressed her belief that Hart was still guilty of the crime, but also stated, quote, "I've always felt in my gut that there was a girl present. Given the DNA results, you have to wonder if there wasn't also a female who took part in the murders," end quote. Of course, the simplest explanation is that this DNA does belong to one of the victims, but combined with the tennis shoe print, you could see why one might be inclined to suspect that a female was involved in the murder. But I don't get the impression that any of the camp counselors set off any red flags for investigators, and as far as I can tell, no potential female suspects have ever popped up on the radar. The other piece of physical evidence which seemed to exclude Hart was the partial fingerprint found on the 9-volt flashlight, which did not match him, but the issue is that a number of stolen items seemed to be used in the commission of this crime. As you recall, a nearby ranch owner reported that nylon rope and rolls of tape were stolen from his home in a burglary shortly before the murders. We still don't actually know where the flashlight came from, but if it was also stolen, could it be possible that the fingerprint belongs to the original owner and has no relevance to this case? Incidentally, the way the situation was handled with the ranch owner perfectly encapsulates what a mess this whole case was. He was given a lie detector test by law enforcement and passed, and this piece of information would be shared in the newspapers. But the problem is that they published this man's name and photograph in the article and framed it in such a way which mistakenly implied that he was considered a serious suspect. As a result, the man wound up getting harassed and receiving threatening phone calls and had to be hospitalized after suffering a nervous breakdown. Anyway, perhaps the oddest thing found at the murder scene were the multiple pairs of glasses which were apparently stolen from counselors and campers during the night and scattered throughout the campground. And of course, a pair of glasses belonging to a counselor was among the items discovered in the cave days later. This is often cited as one of the biggest pieces of evidence of Hart's involvement due to an odd parallel with his previous kidnapping and rape of the pregnant women. Both those victims wore glasses, and Hart tried each pair on in order to test their prescriptions. The scattered glasses at Camp Scott may indicate that Hart stole multiple pairs to try on and took the glasses which most closely matched his prescription with him. I have no idea why Hart would do this, but he may have just had some sort of weird fetish involving women's glasses. It's such an oddly specific similarity between both crimes that it's tempting to believe that Hart was involved. One of the strongest links between the items found in the cave and the murder scene was the discovery of newspaper from the April 17, 1977 edition of the Tulsa World, as pages from that very same edition were found stuffed inside the flashlight to hold the battery in place. The item found inside the cave, which I believe doesn't get enough discussion, are the gloves. One big point which has always been used to support Hart's innocence are the lack of fingerprints found at the crime scene, but that could be explained away if he was wearing those gloves while committing the murder. I think there's little doubt that all those abandoned items belong to the actual killer, but the one item which could be linked to Hart and finally put him on the radar as a suspect were the wedding photographs from 1968. As you might recall, Hart worked as a darkroom assistant for the man who originally took those photos, and one of his duties involved making prints, so Hart could have easily made a few copies of those pictures and pocketed them for himself. So this is going to lead us to one of the most controversial aspects of this story, and that's the allegations of evidence planting. Right from the outset, there were accusations that Mays County Sheriff Pete Weaver had a personal grudge against Hart because he escaped from his custody on two separate occasions, so Weaver was going to use any means possible to pin this crime on Hart. If that's true, that doesn't necessarily mean Hart was innocent, but the authorities still could have planted evidence to strengthen their case against a guilty man. On one hand, it seems very odd that Hart would still be holding on to photographs of a random wedding from 9 years earlier. One potential explanation which has been provided for this is that Hart had an ex-wife and son whom he became completely estranged from after the rape conviction, but one of the women in the photos apparently looked like his ex-wife, so this could have been his motivation for keeping the photos around. At the trial, a former jailer testified that he had seen those very photos on Sheriff Weaver's desk, and while Weaver produced a signed property receipt as evidence that the photos were given back to Hart, I'm sure conspiracy theorists would say that Weaver could have forged that document himself. However, if the police wanted to plant evidence to frame Hart, you'd think they would have used something more convincing than that. In order for this frame-up job to work, Weaver would have to plant these 9-year-old photos, have them published in the newspapers, and then just hope that someone out there would recognize the photos and remember that a wanted fugitive helped develop them so he could use that as justification to charge him with murder. That just seems like a really complicated roundabout way to frame someone. Why not plant a piece of evidence which could be more directly linked to Hart? On the other hand, I do think the discovery of the camp counselor's stolen corncob pipe and hand mirror inside the shack where Hart was hiding out is a bit more shady. These items were apparently lying around in plain sight, but somehow overlooked until the authorities returned to perform a second search of the shack after Hart was arrested, a situation which is very reminiscent of the allegations of evidence planting in the Stephen Avery case. So yes, I don't think it's impossible that those items could have been planted there to strengthen the case against Hart. Now let's talk about the physical evidence, some of which is pretty unique. This trial took place 2 decades before CSI, so you can only imagine how confusing some of this stuff must have been for the jury. First, we have the defense claiming that Hart had to be innocent because the semen samples found at the murder scene contained sperm, which Hart couldn't produce since he had a vasectomy. But then we have the prosecution arguing that Hart's vasectomy was not entirely successful and he was still capable of producing deformed sperm, which happened to share similar characteristics to the sperm from the murder scene. But of course, in the pre-DNA era, they couldn't conclusively prove that any of the sperm or hair samples matched Hart, only that they were similar, and the jury obviously did not believe the matches were compelling enough to render a guilty verdict. And unfortunately, when DNA testing could be performed over a decade later, it still failed to conclusively prove or disprove that Hart was the perpetrator, though investigators stated that they still would have introduced the results into evidence if they had been available at the time of the original trial. While you can't say with 100% certainty that the results implicate Hart, they are still pretty compelling. The semen originated from a non-white male with type O blood who was a secretor, and all these characteristics matched Hart. Even though the DNA samples were not a complete match to him, the odds were such that only one in every 7,700 Native Americans could be a match. Granted, Mays County had a huge Native American population at the time, but the odds of Hart being the perpetrator are pretty strong, if not definitive. But I guess we should take a few moments to talk about alternate suspects besides Hart and the likelihood of them being responsible for the crime. One of these suspects is a convicted murderer named Carl Lee Myers, who was sentenced to death for the 1996 killing of a woman named Cindy Marzano before he died of natural causes in 2012. Incidentally, Marzano just happened to hail from Broken Arrow, the same suburb where Denise, Michelle, and Lori lived. A man named John Russell Penn would claim that while serving time in jail with Myers in 1979, Myers confessed his involvement in the Girl Scout murders to him, but no evidence has ever been found to substantiate the story or link Myers to the crime. Indeed, the main reason I remain skeptical of the story is because not only does Penn have an extensive criminal history of fraudulent activities, but he publicly implicated Myers around the time he was in the midst of writing and directing a fictionalized movie based on the murders called Candles. Penn claimed that he would portray Myers as the killer in the film, and felt this was his only avenue of sharing the information because the authorities would not take him seriously. Quite frankly, I'm not sure if this movie will ever see the light of day. Penn originally went public with this info in 2011. I found an article which stated the movie started shooting in 2016, but if you look up Candles on the Internet Movie Database, it's still listed as being in pre-production. Amusingly enough, the lead actor in the film is John Schneider, aka Bo Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard, who plays the role of an OSBI agent. Overall, I'm not sure I'd bet money on Myers being the perpetrator. Anyway, the man whom Hart's defense team pointed to as an alternate suspect at his trial was William Stevens, but before we discuss him individually, we have to talk about a lead provided by a minister named Gerald Manley. In 1989, Manley contacted a private investigator named Ted LaTurner and claimed that three other men, one of whom was Stevens, had lured him to Camp Scott on the night of the murders and brought him inside Tent 7, where he saw the body of a young girl and two zipped-up sleeping bags before one of the men picked them up and carried them outside. Manley said he had attempted to share this story with the authorities at that time, but they completely ignored him, since they had become convinced that Jean Leroy Hart was the perpetrator. Well, the OSBI did eventually look into Manley's story, but found nothing to substantiate it, and when the Mays County Sheriff met up with Manley and asked him to draw a diagram of the layout of the camp and the tent, Manley could not do this. Once he was threatened with possible arrest for being an accessory to murder, Manley suddenly acknowledged that perhaps he had only dreamt the whole thing. In 1996, Ted LaTurner filed a petition for a grand jury to look into the three men Manley had named, but the petition was tossed out because the information was considered too vague and speculative. Indeed, I have a hard time believing Manley's story as well, though I still want to explore the evidence against William Stevens as an individual suspect. We know that Stevens went to the Kansas State Penitentiary for kidnapping and raping a woman only a few months after the Girl Scout murders, so it sounds like he would have been capable of a crime like this, but it seems like most of the so-called evidence against him is just unreliable hearsay. The girlfriend of Stevens' accomplice in the crime, Dwayne Peters, as well as her son, testified that he borrowed a large flashlight from them prior to the murders, and they saw him the morning after, with claw marks on his neck and red stains on his boots. Peters himself also claimed that Stevens confessed his involvement in the murders to him, but then recanted and said that he made the whole story up because he thought that implicating a fellow inmate would help him get transferred from the Kansas State Penitentiary to an Oklahoma prison. Peters also admitted that his girlfriend fed him details about the Girl Scout murders to make his story sound more convincing. As a result, both she and her son were indicted for perjury, and while the charge against the son was soon dropped, she eventually decided to plead no contest to a lesser charge and received a suspended sentence. While a lot of the physical evidence against Hart was inconclusive, we do know that neither the hair or semen evidence from the murder scene matched Stevens, and even though he was accused of having possession of the 9-volt flashlight, the fingerprint from the lens did not match him either. When it all comes down to it, there really isn't much to tie Stevens to the crime, and I just don't find him to be a very compelling suspect. And really, the lack of a compelling alternate suspect is just another reason I believe that Jean Leroy Hart was the most likely perpetrator of this crime. While the evidence against him may not be conclusive, there are just way too many coincidences for me to believe that he was not involved. I guess the additional unanswered question is whether or not he acted alone. Indeed, while there is some evidence from the murder scene, such as the bloody tennis shoe print and a partial female DNA profile, which suggests that another person might have been there, the deformed sperm found in all the semen samples shows that the same individual committed all of the rapes, and the biological evidence contains many characteristics that match Hart. While there has been some skepticism about Hart being able to handle all three girls single-handedly, I really don't think it's impossible, especially when you consider that he managed to successfully abduct and handle two adult women a decade earlier. If Hart bludgeoned two of the girls while they were sleeping before they had a chance to react, then he would have been capable of committing this crime alone, so I'm comfortable believing that he was the sole perpetrator. The fact of the matter is that Hart's previous crime proved he was capable of a monstrous act such as this, so even though it must have been painful for those three girls' families to see him get acquitted of their murders, at least they didn't have to see him walk free or live for much longer. It's just too bad that forensic science has been unable to conclusively answer the question of his guilt or innocence, as it would be nice to know that there's not some other child murderer out there who managed to get away with it. I know funds are still being raised for more advanced DNA testing, so hopefully this might somehow lead to a definitive resolution someday, and we can finally close the books on this horrible crime for good. But if by chance you happen to have any information that someone else might have been involved in the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Ashlyn O'Brien for doing such a great job at narrating our opening. Like I mentioned in the intro, this has always been a popular, recurring monthly contest, and if you've already entered it before, you are automatically eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you want to enter, and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that the Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we're covering another story which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries about the bizarre failed ransom kidnapping of business executive John Grundhofer by an inept, unidentified criminal who somehow managed to avoid getting caught. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Tritonio, Lee C, Sherry C, Shannon S, Sherry S, and Preston H. Thank you all so much for your support. Just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Of course, I need to provide a big thanks to my two collaborators who have worked with me on this podcast these past 4 years. Miguel Foote, who edits, produces, and assembles these shows, and Vince Nitro, who composes our eerie music score. I definitely could not do this podcast without them. Also, I wanted to announce that once again, I will be representing The Trail Went Cold by appearing at some podcasting events later this year. For the fourth consecutive year, I will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held at the World Center Marriott in Orlando on May 1st to the 3rd. If you would like to purchase tickets and haven't already done so, you can get 10% off by visiting CrimeCon.com and using our specialized promo code, COLD2020. That's COLD2020. And from July the 11th to the 12th, I will be appearing for the second consecutive year at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Lowe's Hotel in Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com. It's surreal to think that this podcast has allowed me to appear at a number of events and live shows these past 4 years. It's been such a pleasure to get to meet and interact with many of you listeners at these events, and I hope to meet many more of you later this year. And since we have reached our 4-year anniversary for The Trail Went Cold, I guess you could say we have successfully completed our first term as a true crime podcast. We never would have gotten this far without the amazing support of our listeners, so thank you all so much for making this such an amazing ride. We are very excited to begin our second term, and almost feel compelled to chant, 4 more years, 4 more years. So once again, have yourself a great week, and join us next Wednesday for our first brand new episode of Year 5 of The Trail Went Cold.